The Mexican artist Frida Kahlo was born 100 years ago today. A significant artist of the 20th century, she continually drew on her homeland, herself and her pain for her subject matter. Joining us tonight on the show to discuss different aspects of Kahlo's work are two curators from the Tate Modern Exhibition that was held in London in 2005. I'm joined first of all by Tanya Barson in London. Tanya, thank you for being with us on the 11th hour. Frida Kahlo was born in Mexico at the beginning of the last century. Can you tell us about her early life?
Well, she was born in 1907, although she later claimed it was 1910, as many people often, she lied about her age, but it was more for political reasons. She claimed she was born in the year of the Mexican Revolution, which began in 1910, in order to identify herself with that newly founded Mexican state. She came from a large family who were living in a small town on the edges of Mexico City called Coyoacán. That small town is now been swallowed up by Mexico City, but at the time it was sort of in the suburbs of the city. And she had a well-to-do, well educated upbringing. Her parents weren't wealthy, but they were. Her father was educated. He was European. He'd immigrated to Mexico. Her mother was a very religious woman, a local Mexican woman, and so she had a mixed heritage, and I think that is very important for her work. She went to one of the most privileged, or in fact the most privileged school in Mexico City. It was a extremely elite school where most of her fellow students were boys. About 2,000 boys went to the school and about 35 girls. So she was already singled out in her early life as being a rather exceptional student and had a very privileged education. Which is interesting when you later come to her work and her construction of herself as a self-trained artist and someone who identifies with the Mexican peasantry through her work, but also through the way that she dressed and the way that she presented herself. She was actually from a very bourgeois background. It's very interesting to go back to her early life and her roots and to really begin to unravel the truth about her. But there are many different tales about Frida Kahlo and her early life, and it's quite difficult to disentangle truth from myth. And that's something that Frida Kahlo herself colluded in, that ambiguity around herself and her personality, which obviously it's become a very important part of her work and her profile, but it's something that she also helped to create, and obfuscating and concealing the real Frida Kahlo behind something that is very constructed.
But there's no doubt in the fact that she was involved in a terrible accident, a street traffic accident, that affected the rest of her life.
Yes, she, as I was saying, she was a very exceptional student, and in her early teens she had planned to become a doctor, and that's what she was training for, and many of her peers became doctors, lawyers, politicians, and she had intended to train as a doctor. But in her late teens, around 17, 18, she had I think she was actually 18, she had an incredibly brutal accident. She was travelling home from school on a local bus, which was a predominantly wooden vehicle. It collided with a tram and was completely crushed. This kind of rather rudimentary bus was crushed, and Frida was one of the most badly injured in that accident. And in fact, the handrail in the bus pierced her body, and this was something that she alludes to in her art. She had quite horrific crush injuries to her leg and her pelvis and her back, and she suffered from complications from that accident for the rest of her life. And it really transformed the direction in which her life took. She had to abandon her studies. She was confined to bed for 9 months and was basically in a complete body cast for that most of that time, and she wore different kinds of casts and corsets, both plaster but also leather and metal corsets and kind of strapping structures around and braces around her torso and her upper body for the rest of her life. And she had many different operations as well throughout her life. So it was something that really had a tremendous impact. I mean, she almost did not survive. It was quite extraordinary that she did survive that accident. And she, as I said, had to abandon her studies. And one of the things that characterises Frida Kahlo is an extraordinary intelligence and inquiring mind. And of course, this 9 months lying flat in her bed was excruciating, not just physically painful, but she was frustrated and thoroughly bored and by this experience. And so they rigged up an easel and a mirror for her, and she began to teach herself to paint and to, you know, that was one of the things that she was able to do while she was bedridden, was to begin to paint, and that's really where her career as a painter begins.
Kahlo herself claimed that there were two accidents that shaped her life. One was the bus and the other was Diego Rivera. What influence did Diego Rivera have on her?
Well, I think, yes, I mean, Rivera was an extraordinary influence on Frida Kahlo, and she had come across him before she'd had her accident. Rivera had returned to Mexico from many years in Europe, and one of the things that he was asked to do almost immediately was, by a minister of culture, José Vasconcelos, was to embark on a number of different mural programs. And one of these murals that he was asked to paint was in the school that Frida Kahlo studied at, the Preparatoria, this quite elite secondary school, I guess, in Mexico City. And so she had seen Rivera as a mature, worldly artist while she was still a teenager. Once she had recovered from her bus accident and she had made a number of paintings, she sought him out when he was working on a different mural program in one of the other ministry buildings in Mexico City, and she showed him her paintings and asked him to tell her if she was any good as a painter or whether she was wasting her time. And he admired her paintings. He found something unique within her painting and so encouraged her to continue to paint. There are different stories about how they met and where they first met and spoke to one another, but that's the generally accepted version of events. Of course, later on they married. In 1929 they married, so that began a lifelong relationship, although they did divorce at one point.
And got married again.
Yeah, they after a year they remarried. So they were divorced for about a year, and then they got remarried and recognised one another as life partners. So they were sort of, even though there was quite an age difference between them, they were, you know, kindred spirit soulmates, I guess. But very different artists, and their work, although they had common political interests and also common cultural interests, the work that they produce is extraordinarily different, kind of polar opposites. The big public epic-scaled muralism of Diego Rivera and the intimate, very intricate and often very, very small-scale paintings of Frida Kahlo seem to suggest, you know, very clearly defined differences, but there's an extraordinarily complicated relationship between the two artists' work that I think we're still trying to kind of work through and work out exactly who influenced who and where the ideas sprung from. But certainly Rivera admired Frida Kahlo's work greatly and said that she was a better artist than he himself.
Tanya, what kind of working relationship do Frida and Diego have?
Well, in a way, they work quite independently of one another. Frida, however, was an incredibly ambitious artist, although to begin with I think that she kept her ambition to herself, and she really felt that she wasn't embarking on her painting as a profession, there was always an underlying ambition there. But when she really became serious about her painting was probably in around 1939, when Rivera and Carlo's marriage was breaking up, and she was facing the prospect of having to, and also wanting to, support herself and not to have to rely on Diego to support her, either emotionally but also financially. And you see a complete change in her paintings, where she makes two huge paintings for her, for the International Exhibition of Surrealism that occurred in Mexico City at that time, one of which has since been lost, The Wounded Table, but the other has become perhaps her most famous work, and that is called The Two Fridas. And it is very noticeably much larger in scale than the other works, and I guess it's her statement of herself as a public and professional painter.
Tanya Barson, thank you very, very much for talking to us about Frida Kahlo. I'm joined now from London by Emma Dexter, co-curator of the 2005 Tate Modern exhibition of Kahlo's work. Emma, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kahlo was a very political painter who was very interested in the plight of our people in Mexico. Is this aspect of her work sometimes overlooked?
Well, in fact, that was something, that very notion was something that we very much focused on when we did our exhibition. I think because her work is very photogenic, her image is everywhere, that's the most famous thing about her, her bodily suffering, her extraordinary sex life, etc. People know about these things sort of by repute. But there is this other side to Frida, perhaps a more serious side, a more politically engaged side. And that's very much what we wanted to try to bring out, obviously not to downplay some of those very subjective and personal aspects of her work and her life. But we very much felt, perhaps, I think it's something that besets many women artists, especially if they have a very important male figure in their life, if they have a very colourful life or a complicated love life, as Frida did. Often the biography can take over, and it means that you don't really get a very rounded picture of her as an artist. And in a way, a lot of women artists do suffer from that all the sort of lifestyle questions rather take over from viewing them as a very serious artistic contribution. So that's very much something we tried to do in that exhibition. And really it starts very early on. There's some very early paintings in which she almost positions herself, if you like, as a sort of very modern woman, a modern subject of this incredible experiment, 20th century experiment, really one of, you know, the first revolution of the 20th century in sort of circa 1910. And it's a period of great upheaval and huge social change in Mexico. But it was a movement that she very specifically wanted to identify with and very much took part in. And so you get some very early paintings, for example, from 1927, one called Pancho Villa and Adelita, in which she positions herself as a sophisticated young woman in cafe society. But behind her, you have these interesting frames that are depicting aspects of the revolution, the role of women in relation to that. Very subtly done, but it's very much she's setting the scene, and that the Mexican Revolution is very much the background to almost everything that she does.
She was an active communist sympathizer all her life. Did that come across in her work as well?
Yes, it certainly did, and I think sometimes quite shockingly, actually, because you'll even see, if you go and visit her home in Mexico City now, you'll see one of the last works that she was still working on when she died, which is unfinished, which is a portrait of Stalin, which is sitting on an easel. So she was really quite unremitting, shall we say, in her support of even the Soviet regime. And, I mean, obviously it's a very complicated and involved history with the relationship that she had with Trotsky as well, which was reputedly an affair, but perhaps just a flirtatious relationship to make her husband Diego Rivera jealous. No one really knows how far the relationship went, but it certainly had an intimate element to it. So, I mean, it's the extraordinary thing about Frida that not only does she have these political ideas, but I mean, I suppose this is why, you know, Hollywood wanted to make a film about her life, that not only does she have this ideology which she believes in wholeheartedly, but the fact that she also, you know, has a romance with one of the most sort of significant communist leaders and ideologues of the 20th century as well, to literally put it into practice, if you like, is obviously one of the reasons why, you know, her biography, whether art historians like it or not, is completely fascinating.
Most people would know Frida Kahlo from her own self-portrait. She painted an awful lot of them, didn't she?
She certainly did. But I think also it's important, I mean, almost all of her works are self-portraits in one way or another. I mean, you can almost see all of her work as a form of self-portraiture. For example, even the still lives, the luscious still lives that she paints. I've got an example here in front of me, The Bride Frightened on Seeing Life, in which there's a little doll that's looking at all these luscious fruits of Mexico. So there's very often a very personal reference, or even some of the papayas or the cactus fruits that have this bruised quality to them, rather like flesh. People, commentators and art historians have very much pointed to the almost autobiographical quality in all of her works, actually.
But in some ways she created herself as an icon.
Absolutely. I mean, she created herself as an icon not just in her work, but also in her life. And so I think when people are arguing, I mean, when art historians argue that her biography overshadows her work, this is also something that Frida kind of created herself, this fascination with her person, her body and her personal life, because she really sort of played to the crowd in terms of how she dressed. She was dressing in these very peasanty style clothing at a time when that was completely out of kilter with how all middle class women, of which she was a member of the middle class, the intelligentsia in Mexico. She was very elaborately decorated, really actually making herself into a little, almost like a little work of art. So yes, I think also that's fascinating, the fact that this sort of bridge between how she presented herself, this construction of an identity. I mean, she had a very fragile and frail beginning, if you like, but something turned in her when she first went to art school and met Rivera, and I suppose some people would say that it was very careerist of her, if you like, to latch on to this much older man, this extremely celebrated artist. And, you know, less kind commentators might say that she used Diego just as much as he used her in terms of the construction of them as this extraordinary artistic couple. You know, very much mutually self-serving in terms of publicity, etc. Because, of course, you have to remember that she was marrying, actually, as a very young woman, one of the most recognised and celebrated artistic figures of the day. I mean, almost somebody like marrying somebody like Damien Hirst, for example, somebody who was really a household name, who was internationally famous and celebrated for his art.
She was obviously a great self-publicist, but how does she fit into the 20th century art?
Well, she's often been associated with the surrealist movement and the sort of Mexican flowering of, sort of late flowering of surrealism there. But she always refused to really be identified specifically as such. I think she very much felt that her own life and her own experience was so extraordinary that she didn't need to indulge in sort of dreams and fantasies. I think the other thing to bear in mind is very much that Mexican culture itself, I think this is a sort of quite a Western-centric viewpoint that we have about the role of fantasy and dream and the sort of the difference between the imagination and reality, which is very much what surrealism was about. But many commentators have pointed out that in Latin American culture in general, the dividing line between imagination and reality is much thinner, and that there is a much richer kind of imaginative culture already there. And perhaps in some ways you can trace it back to Aztec culture, the sort of the thinness of the line between life and death, between night and day, black and white. I mean, a very paradoxical, violent, expressive, life and death giving culture, which is sort of very much evident in Aztec culture and very much present throughout Latin America. And so a lot of people would say that actually she wasn't a surrealist, she was simply expressing her Mexicanness in terms of the way that she might describe her relationship to the earth. So, for example, there's a painting called Roots from 1943 in which she lies upon a completely barren landscape, which might be the sort of landscape that Salvador Dali would be painting. And yet, of course, there is a known area of Mexico in which the landscape is sort of pockmarked by crevasses and is completely arid and deserted in this way. And her body is opening up, and great big leaves with very sort of bloody and vein-like tendrils are feeling their way into the earth. But I mean, you could also say that this is simply a motif that perhaps comes from all sorts of folk art. That was also a very important influence, religious art. So that there are many, I think there are many, many influences on Frida, and to suggest that she's simply a surrealist is really to downplay her sort of geographical and cultural specificity within Latin America. One thing I would like to point out is the fact that I think she's often misunderstood, and this goes back to your very first question about her being a political artist. I think she's underestimated as a satirical artist, and one who had a very trenchant view of the United States of America, because there is one quite extraordinary painting called My Dress Hangs There, which is a painting of New York, which she did in 1933. It's a tiny little painting, and yet it packs an incredibly powerful punch, attacking 1930s Depression era New York and the US in general. So in the foreground of the painting, you have these massed ranks of unemployed people queuing up. You have sort of juxtaposed with that an enormous billboard of Mae West sort of lording it over these poor, impoverished masses. You have a church in which the stained glass window is in fact a kind of dollar sign with a sort of serpent wrapped around it. The centre of the painting is dominated by what looks like a Grecian temple, you know, what should be a place of worship. And yet the steps leading up to the temple are, in fact, when you look at it closely, made of a collage of sort of sales figures. And you have, perhaps most amusingly of all, because this is actually quite a funny painting, if you can bear the biting satire of it, a lavatory bowl sitting atop of a Grecian column, as if perhaps what Carlo is saying is this the complete apogee of American culture. And instead of putting herself in the picture, she simply hangs her very plain and simple Mexican dress from Teotihuacan. And it's just hanging emptily there on a sort of little line that's strung up between the toilet bowl and a sort of golfing trophy. And it's an extraordinary painting. And you know, in some ways, it's still supremely relevant to this day in terms of her view of her position, her feeling of loneliness and isolation in the United States. But at the same time, it's also a sort of terrifying vision of capitalism at work, and I suppose everything that she knew that she already hated at that early stage in her life.
Well, you described that picture wonderfully. Thank you very much, Emma Dexter, for joining us on the 11th hour.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Porrick.